This is Nightlife
with Philip Clark
on ABC Radio.
Joining us for a national news breakdown is The Guardian Australia's political reporter, Amy Remigas. Amy, good evening. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Good evening and thanks for having me back.
Well, we talked about Paul Keating's scathing response to AUKUS last night, a potentially $368 billion deal for Australia to purchase UK-designed submarines. Now the former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull's dished out some criticism. People might roll their eyes at this, but this was Mr. Turnbull on RN Breakfast this morning.
This will take a lot more time, cost a great deal more money, have a lot more risk than if we had proceeded with the submarine project we had with France that Morrison recklessly cancelled and indeed moved to naval nuclear propulsion with France. Now, that would have... I think it is a tragic omission that option was not properly explored, and we will be paying for it, as I said, in terms of dollars, in years lost, and in very high risk of execution.
Well, putting ourselves in peril, can we expand on the idea that how much of more of this from ex-prime ministers can we take, Amy?
Well, it's become a bit of an Australian tradition, hasn't it, for former prime ministers to pop up and just give their opinions on, you know, pretty much every political decision of the day. It's a bit of a symptom of what happens when you have too many former prime ministers within a decade. So everyone still has a lot of opinions on a lot of things. Having said that, that doesn't mean that there's not valid points in both what Mr. Keating and Mr. Turnbull have said. They have raised some valid concerns and some valid criticisms of this deal that Australians still don't know a lot about. And one of the other things that Mr. Turnbull raised in his interview with Patricia Carvelis this morning was that we don't have a nuclear industry in Australia, and we're about to become the only country that will have nuclear-propelled submarines without actually having a nuclear industry. So in the US and the UK, when naval officers and personnel finish up on the submarines, they go off and they work in the nuclear industry in their country. In Australia, what do they do? Where do they go? Where do they take those state secrets? Are they forced to go offshore, or will Australia end up with a nuclear industry by default as one of the flow-on effects from this? What Mr. Turnbull was talking about in terms of the UK not exactly being in the strongest economic position, I mean, also, there's no lie in that. Brexit obviously has not been great for the British economy. Will they be able to have the investment to put into their military and to the Navy that is required as part of the AUKUS deal to ensure that Australia does get, you know, its technology and its subs? These are questions we should be answering instead of having a debate over whether former prime ministers are right to critique this or not.
Yes, this was Mr. Turnbull on whether whether the UK is up to the challenge of being a long-term partner in the project. I mean, the place is in turmoil at the moment economically. This is what Mr. Turnbull had to say.
The UK has real challenges, and unlike France, it is not actually in the Asia Pacific. You know, France has huge territories, 2 million citizens in our part of the world. So it doesn't have to pivot to Asia, it's here. I'm an Anglophile, right? I love the UK and have got no hang-ups about the
draping
British.
Draping yourself but in the flags, is, yep.
Yep, that's right. That's right. But the bottom line is their economy is thick. It's got fundamental sort of existential problems, and you've got to ask yourself whether Britain is going to be able to sustain investment in its navy and its military in the years ahead, given the huge demands that they've got elsewhere, not least of all in their National Health Service.
Yeah, well, some might say, well, look, hang on, you were Prime Minister briefly. What were you doing about any of these things? And the answer was not much.
Well, his answer was the French submarines. I mean, one of the reasons that Malcolm Turnbull is such a big defender of the French submarine contract is because he was the author of it. That was one of his legacies, and it got torn up by Scott Morrison, and he's been riding in its defence ever since. But we also have to remember that the French originally offered us nuclear-propelled submarines, and then we said, no, thank you, we don't do nuclear. And so then they spent all of this money saying, okay, well, we will denuclear nuclearize them, if that's even a word, and create, different submarines. And then we said, okay, no, thank you. We're going for the nuclear reactor submarines. So thanks very much, but no, we're going to pass. Mm. It's been a mess. Defense contracts always seem to be a mess. Submarines in particular seem to be a complete and utter cluster every single time Australia gets involved. And I think that's why there are a lot of questions over whether or not this is something that we can even afford to do, let alone what the ramifications are going to be over the next few decades of having an increased military presence in this region.
These things cost money, but to be fair, the Collins-class submarine was a first-class submarine by the time that it emerged. It has not been a dud. Indeed, in joint exercises with the United States, it's performed exceptionally well.
I did like how you said when it emerged, given, the delays that have been in
that. Well, that's true. But all sophisticated weapons seem to have these problems. I mean, look at the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter project, of course, which, nearly bankrupted several countries, including the US. But anyway, they're here now. We're flying them. They work. And from all accounts, are extraordinarily effective.
Yeah, I wish I could have the same sort of deadlines as a rolling defence contract and the same sort of consequences for not delivering on time. That would make my work life a lot easier.
The question of who's going to pay for this, Amy, is obviously a point. Although, I think most observers have said, most sober observers at least have said, look, these big figures, $400 billion, it's over 30 or 40 years, and if you extrapolated most government projects over that length of time, you'd get even bigger figures, particularly big health and welfare projects over that period of time. So it is not as though we're suddenly cranking up massively defence expenditure on this, although the degree of bipartisanship on this has meant that Peter Dutton has said that the coalition would support program cuts to pay for the submarines. How does that sit?
Well, I mean, it depends on the program, because he doesn't want to see defence cannibalised to pay for this, and that's in response to the fact that $9 billion is the upfront cost over the forwards, so over the next 4 years, and the government is saying that this is a cost-neutral four-year cost because they're going to take $6 billion from the French submarine contract that's no longer there, so that's $6 billion, and then they've got another $3 billion that they're going to find in savings within defence. Peter Dutton has gone, no, would prefer you didn't find the savings in defence, that you look elsewhere, including things like the NDIS. And that just opens up a whole ballpark of what else could potentially be cut or not have future funding committed as we look to pay for this over the next 30 years. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. It's not a case as if like this is like some huge cost that's due in the next decade. However, why is it only defence that we cannot afford to not do this? I never want to hear a government again say they can't afford to act in terms of climate change, or they can't afford to raise the rate, or they can't afford to invest in Medicare because it's too expensive. Well, I think the answer to that is, how can we afford not to invest in those programs, given the rising inequality in Australia and given how we always do seem to have money for defence? Strategic defence is absolutely important. It is important that Australia be able to protect its borders. We are in a changing world. I have not been privy to the defence briefings, obviously, but I can understand why when China is boosting its military spend, we also need to respond in the way that we have. However, I do not understand why we cannot apply that thinking to any other giant societal problem that we have in Australia. We always put a cost on the things that end up costing us the most in terms of our quality of life. And I think it's time that stopped.
Fair enough. All right. So, look, Paul Keating is always trying to make a splash when he opens his front door, puts on his double-breasted jacket and emerges. Anthony Albanese, quite frank, was quite blunt today when he said Mr. Keating was just simply incorrect. No one wants. I mean, no Labor leader currently wants to be seen to be slagging Mr. Keating, but I don't think they're really suffering much damage, are they, from it? Do you think?
Uh, I don't think that they're suffering much damage from it, because the people who believe in the program will believe in the program, and the people who don't won't. And those lines are fairly, you know, strong and thick, and they're not moving. I think it would have absolutely hurt Anthony Albanese to be compared to Billy Hughes, who's
known to be
one of Labor's biggest rats.
One of the all-time political rats of Australia.
but also particularly when it comes to, you know, to his time in the Labor Party, when he almost destroyed the Labor Party, with his actions. So it's hard not to say Billy Hughes without hearing "you dog" almost immediately afterwards, given when you talk to, you know, Labor members, that's how they refer to him. So that absolutely would have hurt Anthony Albanese to hear Paul Keating make that comparison in terms of decisions and bad decisions. But also, I'm pretty sure that the Prime Minister, the Foreign Minister and the Defence Minister were well aware of Paul Keating's concerns before he ventilated them, and absolutely expected what came out of the National Press Club on Wednesday.
I am sure that's right. Meanwhile, there seems to be something of a kind of pointless debate about where we're going to dispose of high-level nuclear waste in Australia from the submarines, given that I think this problem cannot possibly arise, given the timetable of all these things, given the subs have a 30-year life and so on. We won't be even confronting this problem for 30 to 50 years, probably 50 years. Mm-hmm. New South Wales, Victoria and South Australia are getting on their high horse already, saying, well, we're not going to be, you know, the repository of high-level nuclear waste. Who knows what's going to happen in 50 years' time, quite frankly.
Well, exactly. But there's nothing that we love more than in AusPol than to have pointless arguments about
completely pointless,
you know, about like potential hypotheticals sometime in the next half century. Like, that's pretty much one of AusPol's underpinnings, where we go, this could be a problem at some point in the future. And then we go spend a lot of time and effort and column inches and audio talking about these hypotheticals, and we get a lot of experts to say what could happen, but we don't really deal with, you know, the actual problems that are in front of us immediately. Always easier to think about, you know, those hypothetical issues than the ones that are absolutely right in front of us.
Amy Remekis is with us from Guardian Australia. On to a couple of other things. The unemployment rate today, figures came out, still buoyant. It's fallen to 3.5% in February after more than 64,000 Australians found work. I mean, these are extraordinarily robust figures, and a rate of 3.5%. Gee, once upon a time, you would have politicians would have had, you know, ecstasy over such things. But the figures also say something about the economy, and that means probably that further interest rate rises are on the way, aren't they?
Well, we know that there's at least one interest rate rise coming, that the RBA is still not comfortable with where inflation is at, and that it's not falling quick enough. And the RBA's target rate of 2 to 3%, they take it as like real inflation. So the inflation underpinning all the inflation without all those volatile price increases and decreases and all the rest of it. But they're not seeing what they want to see. We do have a tight labour market, but it also has to be said that in terms of entry-level positions, there is still high competition for those positions. And if you speak to some of the anti-poverty advocates, they're reporting, like, you know, you're getting more than 15 people applying for some of those entry-level positions. So both things can be true at the same time. There's also been, you know, an increase over the last couple of months in the number of people who have more than one job, which also says something about the economy and the fact that we have quite a lot of insecure work at the moment. So when we're talking wage rises, when we're talking, you know, tight employment market, we're usually talking about those mid to high level jobs, which, you know, is available to educated people or to people who are skilled or to people who have moved up through the workforce. And there has been a gap there because of the pandemic. When we closed our borders, we lost a lot of workers that we need. But we don't often talk about a lot of the problems that are underpinning all of that, which is, you know, we still have a problem with a lower skill skilled workforce. We still have problems when it comes to entry-level jobs, and we still have problems with raising people out of poverty within that market. So there's a lot of interesting stories to be told in the unemployment rate that one number doesn't necessarily represent. And I will also add, I think it's probably going to show some changes to how Treasury and the government and the RBA think of full employment. So full employment means that there's a particular number of people who are unemployed to help keep inflation low. That's part of our economic system, part of like the underpinnings of how we work the whole country. They build in unemployed people essentially to try and keep the economy healthy. That number has been around 4 or 5%. They're now talking about how that number could potentially have a 3 in front of it that they would recalculate, but that still means that you're going to have a huge group of people who are unemployed to try and help the economy. And that's also something that we need to think about, because if you're going to have these people helping the economy by not having a job, then maybe we should pay them a little bit more to survive on while they look for jobs.
Yes, fair enough too. Just finally, Amy, what's on the agenda for next week's parliamentary sitting?
What isn't on the agenda for next week's parliamentary sitting? We have the housing fund. We're going to have some more super fights. We're going to have a little bit more fight over the Referendum Machinery Act, which is basically the legislation that they put through to set up the referendum. All of that is going to be happening in the next couple of weeks because Anthony Albanese is back in town. And so now it's time to get some of that stuff done before we head into the budget period, which is, of course, coming in the first week of May.
Yep, indeed. All right, Amy, good to talk. Thank you.
Yeah, always a pleasure.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.